everyone. I'm Carter. This is Making It Up. So this is a show where I talk to other authors. We have a nice chat. And at the end, we make up a story together. So today's episode was pretty cool. Today, I talked to Julie Clark, whose 2020 thriller, The Last Flight, just completely blew up. Blowing up is probably not the right term, using flight. It took off. Her novel took off totally. It sold a lot of goddamn copies is what I'm talking about. So it instantly became a New York Times and USA Today best-selling novel. So that's just awesome. So we talked about like what it's like for her to juggle being a writer and also being a fifth grade school teacher. And I'll give you a hint. It has something to do with getting up at 3:45 in the morning every day. Julie also shares some just tremendous insight about how she navigates the publishing industry, as well as how she maintains a healthy work-life balance as a single parent. And we also get to talk about one of my favorite things to do in writing, which is making a character disappear off the grid, which has a lot to do with her novel, The Last Flight, and the research that goes into figuring that out. And at the end of our chat, we make up a pretty surreal kind of circus-based story that involves lots of mirrors. So anyway, it was a lot of fun. Hope you enjoy. This is my conversation with Julie Clark.
How are you?
How are you?
I'm great, thanks. So you have a whole setup there. Look at you.
I do have a setup. I've got books and a microphone and everything.
Yeah. So
tell me about your setup. Where are you?
I am in my office attached to the garage where I do most of my teaching and working. Wow. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Now you're in California, right?
Uh-huh. Los Angeles.
Where in Los Angeles?
Santa Monica area.
Okay. But you grew up there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was that like?
Growing up in Santa Monica?
Oh my God. Santa Monica is such a nice place.
Yeah, it was great. You know, Santa Monica is different now than it used to be a long time ago. When I was growing up here, it was a small little sleepy beach town.
Yeah.
We have a main street that goes down from the east side of Santa Monica to the west side called Montana. And it was just a very, tons of gas stations, AM/PM, mom and pop shops,
totally.
Bakeries, yeah. Things like that, a pharmacy. And now it's like paparazzi central, you know, so it's all high-end boutiques and, you know, restaurants that have like really crowded seating and, you know, two little scallops on a plate and they charge you $30 for it, that kind of thing, you know, so it's very different. Hollywood now.
Are you pretty rooted there though? Like, do you feel like it might be a place that you would leave at some point or?
No, I'm all in. I mean, I think of Santa Monica as two different layers. There's the top layer that's the Hollywood and, you know, the rich people who move here to be in the industry. And then there's this subculture of people who have been here forever. We've always been here. We're not going anywhere. The locals, and we just kind of operate separately.
Yeah. So I left and then, you know, went to New York for school and then kind of lived all over the place. And whenever I would come back and visit LA, it was almost kind of insufferable because I had been away from it. And then just, it was too much, too many. I mean, Santa Monica is different. Santa Monica is a little bit more insulated perhaps, but, I love going back there, but LA is tough for me to envision rooting down again.
Yeah. I mean, my kids are going to school here. My parents are here. And so, you know, we're here for the long haul probably, you know, and it's one of those things where if you consider moving away, you know, selling your house, and if you move out of the area, you'll never be able to move back. I mean, that's a fundamental truth about the property values here. So you really need to be ready to make a break forever because there's no coming back. So that's also sort of what will keep me here probably. And the weather, which I keep.
Well, I'm in Colorado and we definitely have a good number of people from California coming in just, you know, for various different reasons, but and I moved here from Miami. So 20 years ago, so I'm no different. And then growing up, what did your parents do?
My mom sold real estate and my dad was a CPA.
Okay. So the writing link didn't come directly from them.
No, no, not at all.
Can you trace that somewhere? Or at least the creativity?
I mean, I would say that my brother and I are both very creative. He's a comic book artist.
Oh.
And so he
does. Does he let you say comic book, or do you have to say graphic novels?
Well, they're different. So comic books are comic books, and graphic novels are comic books in long form.
So he's truly a comic book artist.
Yes. Although he's written a couple graphic novels as
Very cool. Yeah.
So he works for DC and Marvel and does all that, but he lives in Japan. So he's,
he's a whole different life.
Yeah. So he's been, you know, he's very creative and I'm very creative as well. So it's not really a surprise.
I find it so interesting because some people, it's like, oh, I fell in love with books because I was reading since I was five. And other people like myself, it's just, I kind of just started doing it later in life. And I don't really quite know totally where it came from.
Yeah, no, that was the same for me. I mean, I am an avid reader. I'm always reading, constantly reading. I think my kids' first words were put the book down. And so I just have always, like, that's been my MFA, really. It's just my reading life. I don't have a graduate degree in creative writing. I don't have any degree in creative writing. Right. I have a degree in graphic design, though. But and so I came to it later in life. I probably didn't start writing seriously for publication until I was maybe 43 or so.
Yeah. My degree is a Bachelor of Sciences in Hotel Administration. So right. I didn't take a single English or literature class in college, not one.
Exactly.
It's an interesting conversation to have you as somebody who's like, okay, I'm writing now. Am I doing it right? How do I know what to do next? How do I publish a book? Where does it all? Because, you know, I was 33 when I started writing, but, you know, I wrote this book and then I didn't know anything about what the next steps were. So I was just furiously Googling.
Yes. Tons of Googling.
Right. And it's so funny now when people come, I don't know if this happens to you, but they'll ask for your advice. Like, well, how do I get an agent? Just get on the internet. That's Google what I had it. To I do.
There's so much information out there. I mean, I always want to be really generous with advice only because I didn't really know who to turn to myself.
Right.
And so, but at the same time, you know, as far as finding an agent and finding a publisher, like, you just kind of have to do it one step at a time. You know, there's no shortcut. And what happened for me and the way that it happened for me won't be the way that it happens for somebody else, because it's different for every single person, almost like a fingerprint. It's just, there's no one path, and you can't even measure by any kind of metric as to how you're doing. Am I close? Am I, you know, well, if this happened for you, then maybe if that happens for me, then X, Y, or Z. And it's just not.
You're 100% right. And it's all about, I think, setting individual goals and what would make you feel successful. And to me, like, I wrote this book and I was embarrassed that I had done it in a way. I hadn't really told anybody I did, because I didn't know what I was doing. And so my one goal was like, I'm going to try to get an agent, because that would be one person who's not related to me who is willing to take a risk on me. And to me, that was a massive measure of success.
Same exact thing for me. I didn't tell anybody I was writing a book. Everybody's writing a book, right? Like, why am I different? Why am I special?
Well, what if you don't finish the book? And then 3 years, they're going to say, well, how's that book going?
Exactly. I didn't want the questions of like, how's the book, right? And I mean, I really initially started to write because I needed to pay for preschool. Like, that's really expensive. Do you know preschool is so expensive out here in California? Yeah. It's basically the rent for a one bedroom apartment in Santa Monica. And so I needed money. And it's kind of a silly joke now, because by the time I actually got any money from my writing, my kids were 12 and 9.
Right. It's probably not the best advice to say, well, I needed money, so I decided to become an author.
If you need money, don't think you're going to get it when you need it. I mean, it's great, but I didn't tell anybody. I didn't want anybody to know. I didn't want anybody to ask. And I did feel like if I can get an agent, then I can start telling people, because that sort of, for me, was sort of a measure of legitimacy of like, I'm not just some person who's, you know, writing a book in my free time. Like, I'm a serious writer and I have a chance of actually getting published.
Right.
And so at that point I did start. And people were shocked. They were like, you're writing a book? You're kidding me. And I'm like, yeah, and I already have a literary agent. So, you know, yes, right. I'm writing a book. And it was very weird to start like sharing that.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Well, and then, you know, years down the road to even get to the point to tell, because I think you and I both have other jobs as well, to, mm-hmm. you know, to meet somebody at a cocktail party and they say, what do you do?
Yeah.
To me, if I ever said I'm a writer, I felt like a fraud. And I, you know, after 5 or 6 books were out, I'm like, okay, I can at least include that.
Right.
And right. maybe I'll even lead with it every now and then. But
right. But, it's funny. I don't really either. I don't really. I mean, when people say, what do? I say, I'm a teacher, you know? Yeah. And every now and then, like one of my kids will be like, well, you also write books. And it's like, yeah. Oh yeah. And I'm an author too. And then like, yeah, well, have you written anything? Yeah. And then yes.
It's funny. Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think a lot of authors have just, and just, I don't know, a self-confidence issue. I mean, everyone, you can be so proud of what you've written, but also so scared of what you've written. And I think that kind of parlays itself into how you present yourself to the world as well. I know a lot of writers who are very just, you know, almost embarrassed by their works, even though they're ferociously proud of it as well. So how did you, so what was, so you went to, but just backing up a little bit. So You went to college.
Yeah.
And what did you study?
Graphic design.
Graphic design. That's right. So you're going to be a graphic designer, right. which is a valid, good career choice. You know, lots of good jobs that give you a steady paycheck and insurance. And mm-hmm. you graduated, and then what?
I did that for maybe 9 months and realized that I wasn't really cut out for sort of the cutthroat design firm environment. I didn't like the competition.
This was in Los Angeles where you were working?
No, this was up north in Northern California where I went to college. And the design firms that I was applying to be a junior designer at were just incredibly cutthroat. And I just remember thinking to myself, like, I'm not really sure I have the stomach for this. Yeah. And I think that also I had some doubts as to my abilities, as to whether I could really compete talent-wise as well. I'm a decent artist, but my brother's the talented artist, right? Yeah. Like we're just different. And I majored in graphic design because I liked art and, maybe shouldn't have done that. I'm a very capable artist, I would say, but I wouldn't say that the creativity and the artistic side, like the visual arts, comes naturally to me. You know,
yeah, and maybe so, the passion wasn't quite there as well.
I just didn't feel that was where I really wanted to be. And so I decided to go back. I worked in athletics for a while as I was sort of just, okay, well, I'll do that. And I worked in the athletic department at Berkeley for 4 or 5 years and then kind of realized athletics isn't really what I want to do either. I was doing fundraising, which was interesting. And then I decided I wanted to go back to school and get my teaching credential. And so that's what I did. I went to school, quit my job and went to school full time for a year to get my credential. And then when it came time to find a job where I wanted to be, I knew that I wanted to go somewhere where I was willing to settle for a while. So it was really a decision. Do I want to stay in Northern California or do I want to move back home to Southern California? And I really knew that the next step in my life would be, you know, having kids and starting a family. And I wanted to be closer to my parents for that, which has been a lifesaver for me. Best decision I ever made was to move home closer to my parents because they're very, very involved in my kids' lives. And I'm just so lucky to have them. I mean, they're just, it's an all hands on deck kind of situation. So
what grades are your kids in?
9th and 6th.
Okay.
Yeah.
A little bit older than mine.
Yeah. And so that's kind of what brought me back home.
So did you know when you were getting your teaching credentials, what you wanted to teach and what ages you wanted to teach?
Yeah. I mean, I have an elementary credential, so I can teach anything from K-6 and I teach 5th grade and I've been in 5th grade for 23 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow. And in a public school system or?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you so just love it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great job. It's fun. It's engaging. It definitely, whatever problems I'm having or frustrations I'm having with the writing and publishing world, of which there can be many, going to school every day and sitting with kids and working with kids, like you just forget it for 6 hours, it's gone. And by the time you leave and you're like, oh yeah, I was really upset about that. You're like, oh well, you know, you just don't care, you know?
It's an interesting, you know, cause one of my, so my whole writing career is based up on goals, right? And so I'm very goal oriented, and now it feels like kind of the next goal would be, hey, I want to be able to write full time, because it always feels like this great, pearly gates kind of a thing. And there are times where I'm like, I don't know if that's so great. I don't think it is.
I mean, I have had stretches of time where I've not been working and thought, this is going to be great. I can write, you know, it'll really give me a feel for, you know, writing full time. And the truth of the matter is I don't actually write any more, like time-wise,
right,
than I do when I'm working. And there's a whole lot of snacking that happens that, you know, I'm not really inclined to want to do long-term. The other thing too, is that I just don't think I ever want to depend on a sale or an advance or royalties to pay my bills, you know, or to support my kids. You know, my kids are heading into college in the next few years, and I'm going to have to pay for that. And I just, I think it would be stifling creatively. You know, I'm a single mom, so I'm the only income in the house. And so to not have anything to fall back on would be really scary. And I like health insurance too.
So we have very parallel stories. I'm a single dad, and it's the same thing. And it's, and I think you still have to really enjoy that other work, right? Because it's not like,
I mean, absolutely. I mean, there are days where I'm like, oh, I can't wait till I retire, you know, and it's seven years. I've got 7 years in my head, and I'll hit 30 years teaching, and I'll be, you know, ready to retire. And I'll get enough from my pension that will, you know, cover my bills, and then book money will be extra, and that will be great.
Yeah, well, that's tremendous. So what was the impetus for the first thing that you wrote? You said you know, like me, you were older when you started doing that. What was the catalyst for it?
Mostly I just wanted to see if I could do it, you know.
So you'd been thinking about the idea of writing a book.
A long time. I mean, years and years and years. It was, you know, it's always been something that I've wanted to do. Or, you know, every time I read a good book, I would have this feeling of like, I want to do that, you know? But I didn't even know really where to start. And then I just kind of woke up one day and realized, like, why not just start? You know, like, instead of trying to figure out where to start, just start. And so I wrote a book. It took me, I don't know, 4 or 5 months to draft. And then I spent several months revising it and started looking for an agent and queried many, many agents, and didn't go anywhere. And then, so I thought, okay, well, I'll write another one. And so I wrote another book, and that one was the one that ended up getting me my agent. And that was my debut, The Ones We Choose, which came out in 2018. And, and I just kind of, you know, with writing, it's sort of, you just do the next thing, you know?
That you're 100% right. Yeah. So my first book got me an agent after 75 rejections, but my first three books didn't sell. Mm-hmm. And halfway through that first year of going through those rejections, I started to panic and be like, you know, shit, my agent's, why wouldn't she drop me if this doesn't sell? Like, why, there, you know, so let me quickly write another one. And then, you know, you got into a routine where, and then you start to read the rejections and you're like, okay, I can really learn from this. This is like helpful information of why these editors are reading my book and writing like four paragraphs of why they want it. That's amazing.
I didn't really see a lot of, I asked my agent not to pass it on unless it was valid, like that we could do something with. So like with The Last Flight, you know, we submitted it to many editors and got some rejections early on. And I asked her, like, is there any like consensus, right?
A common theme of rejection.
And she was like, no, they're all over the map, which means that it's just a personal taste thing. And we got lucky with The Last Fight. We ended up with four houses being interested in it. And so
the
source books just swooped in and said, goodbye, everybody.
Are you, is Anna your editor?
No, Shana.
Shayna. Okay. Yeah. I've been with Anna for four books now, and they're, I mean, source books, I could go on and on and on about, but I've been with a lot of different publishers, and the way that they approach, and because I'm also a data and analytics guy. So the way that they approached that in a very opaque industry where a lot of people are very fluffy about numbers and we don't really know what works. We don't really analyze source books. We'll take a look at, like, this is what has been proven to work. This is what we think. Right. Here's So I have a lot of respect for that. They've been fantastic. So how much do you write in a day typically? What is your schedule?
I am up at about 3:45 every morning. I write from about 4 to 6 or 6:30 usually. And then I'm done for the day.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll have weekends are a little different. I'll sleep in. I slept until 5 today and got some work done. I have a little bit more work I want to do this afternoon, but I generally try to do my writing work first before I do anything else, because if I don't, I have a tendency to not want to go back to it, or I have a tendency to be really bitter about having to sit down and work, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, a 2 to 2.5 hour block is substantial in my opinion. Like there are people who sit down for 4 or 5 hours, and I don't have, you know, even if I didn't have the other gig, I don't think you'd have to build that muscle to be able to do that.
I mean, I think it depends on the stage you're in though. Like when I'm doing edit for my editor, it's 4 or 5, 6 hours a day on the weekends for sure. Or if it's on a vacation, if I'm trying to do those revisions, but usually by the time I'm at a place where I'm doing revisions for my editor, I know the story, the characters, the plot set, everything is, there's not a lot of like thinking to do.
Right.
That actually does happen when I'm not sitting at my desk.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
But it's exhausting. Any part of it can be exhausting because you are so into a task that is either commanding your creative abilities or just the, you know, sitting and staring at words on the screen.
Yes.
It's exhausting. I do about an hour a day. I write at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and I grab, you know, a martini, and I have a little place that I go in my house then. And I don't really think about my stories at all until I sit down, and then I'm just in a world and I can be hyper productive and then come out of it and then feel accomplished. So
it's
interesting.
I think that people have a misunderstanding that authors are at their desks for 6 to 8 hours every day, and that in order to write a book, you really need to have that kind of time. You really don't. You really don't. And actually, it's counterproductive. If you're trying to sit at a desk for 4 to 6 hours to be creative, generally, maybe the first few hours will be really great, and then the last several hours will be awful.
Like stuff that you're going to have to really heavily read, likely.
It's not going to be useful anyway.
Yeah.
You know? And I generally have a sense of when I've hit that mm-hmm. moment, you know, like when I'm writing and I'm thinking to myself, like, this is really something I need to do tomorrow.
Yeah.
And it's not procrastination. It's really like, that's when my brain is going to be fresh again, and when I'll have some more ideas about it. And
right. You know, I actually love, you know, writing and then stopping right as it's about to get great. Like, I can't wait to write this scene.
Yeah.
Stop. And like, now I've got this tomorrow as my launching
design, to,
rather than like, oh, I've got to do all those edits again.
Yeah.
Everybody's different for sure. And you feel like, you know, so I always ask myself or try to analyze myself, and I think we're similar in terms of how we learned. Yeah, how do you get better as a writer? And you know, you've written, and once you write enough manuscripts, you kind of feel like, okay, I know what I'm doing, but how do I get better? You know, we don't have classes that we went to, or we're not necessarily taking classes.
Hey, do you
just look at what you've written and just you get a sense of, okay, now I see how I just organically get better, or do you?
I think some of it is organic. I think some of it is, you know, building a muscle. You certainly get faster at it.
For sure.
More efficient, I would say, not faster. But I think the way you get better is to read.
Yeah.
I think just reading widely, not just inside of your genre, but across genres, I think, helps. Finding people, whether you know them as authors or not, to be your mentors in a way, to study them and to take their books apart and to really deconstruct them, is something that you can do on your own. And it's, you know, not free. Well, I guess it could be free if you go to the library. But I think that that for me is how I grow. You know, I could take classes. I mean, but I don't have time to take classes really. But maybe someday I would. So, I certainly don't want to like rule that out, but it's not, you know, I'm a big believer in like opportunities present themselves when you're ready for them.
Yeah.
And writing is very much that way. And so solutions and lessons and ideas will come if you just let them, you know.
You're absolutely right. I mean, you could teach classes too, you know,
because
I'll look at classes and I'll think, well, they might suggest this is the way that you write a book. And I'll feel like, well, I've kind of done that. And whether I do it your way or not, I kind of feel like I have a way that works for me. I want to know, you know, the small little things that I can improve upon, or just feel like every book, like I'm getting stronger and you know, faster and that kind of a thing.
I think a good editor will do that for you.
Yeah.
I think having not just your editor at your publishing house, but also an outside developmental editor that you work closely with that understands what you're trying to do. And those kinds of people can also push you forward in a way. And, you know, just having a really solid stable of critique partners.
Totally. And if they're within the industry, they can also help you. I've talked about this with some other authors on this podcast about, you know, your editor will also have other thoughts in mind aside from the story. They're thinking about your name, your brand,
you
know, potentially packaging even early on. Like, does this all work? And something that you might not have had front and center of mind as you were writing. And that's always helpful too, because my agent's great at that. It's like, well, you know, your last four books featured this. Now you're trying to do this. I don't know if that is the best decision.
Right.
And that doesn't mean you have to take that advice, but it's great to hear because you might not be aware of it. The further along you get, you know, within whatever it is that you're writing. So, you know, Anna at Source Books for editing, like I don't think I've ever had a large suggestion that I've ever disagreed with. I'm like, oh, you're totally right. This makes it so much better.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've only worked with two editors. I was at Simon & Schuster with my first book and then with Source Books with this one, and had just had phenomenal experiences with both editors. Just, you know, and I think my first book had like a 20-page edit letter, and I think Shana sent me a 15-page edit letter for The Last Flight. I mean, but every single suggestion was like, oh, yeah, okay, all right. You know, I mean, everything. And so for me, like, the edit letter is, it's not upsetting in the sense that, like, you don't understand what I'm trying to do. It's not that. It's
a little upsetting. Overwhelming.
It's overwhelming and upsetting at the amount of work that has to be done.
Right.
You know, but it never, my experience also is that it never is as much work as it feels like at the beginning, right? You just pick a place and begin. And pretty soon you're not paying attention to how long it's going to take. You're just doing it. And then it's done. And then that wasn't so bad. You know,
but you're pretty much stopping everything else for about a month. And it's, you know, and there's some things like I'll have, you know, I remember Anna just said once, my edit letters aren't usually very long, but some of the comments are just very broad. Like, I'm just feeling we need a subplot. Okay. But there's no suggestion of like what to do, which is great. And, you know, there'll be the reason
I always make a point of talking to my editor after the edit letter that I can talk through stuff.
Yeah.
Because to me, that's really helpful to talk through. Okay. So we need a subplot. Like, what did you have in mind?
Right.
You know, like female, male, like, what are we doing here? Is it, you know, romantic relationship? Is it, you know, what's happening? Yeah. But I think that they do have an idea, and even just the brainstorming.
Yeah.
helps so, so much.
Yeah, that's true. And to be fair, she's probably more specific than that on a lot of things, but I'm a little bit the opposite where, you know, she will leave things very open.
Yes.
And say, hey, I'm totally here to talk. Yeah. And I get very much like, I don't want to brainstorm. I want to figure out this puzzle myself. Yeah. I want to come up with something. Yeah. I don't know why, but I feel like it's my responsibility. I'm like, oh, I'm supposed to do all this.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it's, I just got finished with edits for what's coming out next year. And then, you know, you get the second level of edits and it's like, it's like nothing. And you're like, oh, okay. It's kind of done.
Yeah.
This book is kind of done now.
That's a scary moment too. You know, I haven't read The Last Flight since we did Last Pages way back and I don't even know when, right? Over a year ago. And I've had, it was on, Hank Phillippe Ryan's first chapter FUD where she read the first chapter out loud. And I was watching, I watched it after it was recording because I was working while they did it. But I was like, oh, that's not bad. You know, I mean, because I'm always terrified.
I would read this book.
I guess I could read that book. Yeah. I mean, I'm always terrified that I'm going to hear something and be like, what was I thinking? You know, why did I say it like that? Right. Well, that just sounded ridiculous. Why did I put a period there instead of a comma?
Yeah. So totally. You have to appreciate the good with the bad, because I'll definitely have those moments. For me, it's when I'm preparing to do a reading. Like I do a lot of work to do a reading. I make sure it's very polished and I'm going through stuff and I will totally rewrite it.
Oh, me too. I have in my book that I, you know,
it's all marked up, right?
It's all marked up. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to switch that word out for this word. Like nobody
would know. Well, and you're editing for time a little bit too, because you only have 5 minutes. You want to go to a certain place, but you're like, oh, there's a repeat of a word right there. That sounds ugly. Because you're reading out loud and you're catching so much more. That's why I can't even listen to the audio versions of my books.
Oh, no.
It freaks me out. I've heard like a few sentences here and there, but that's just it.
Yeah, no, I haven't either. Although I have to say, like, I get a lot of praise for my audio narrators. They did a fantastic job. And
I do too. People get attached to them. Yeah. Yeah. And you're just thankful that that's awesome. Yeah. Well, listen, we're going to make up a very short story.
Okay.
And I can see you're thrilled about this.
We'll see.
No, it's usually a disaster, which is the best part of it. So you're going to help me choose a book from behind me and then a sentence, and then I'll read that sentence. And then you give me whatever you want, one or two sentences, and then we'll go back and forth, just crafting whatever we want. And then I'll call an end to it after a little bit. So let's pick a number. Give me a number between 1 and 3.
Between 1 and 3? Yeah. Well, there's only one between 1 and 3. 2.
You can include 1, 2, or 3.
Okay. 2 is fine.
Okay. And then 1 through 7.
7.
And then let's say 1 through 10.
I'm going to say 5.
Okay. So that's going to be the bookshelf, the column, and the number of the book. So I'll be right back.
Okay.
This was given to me by a guy who's from my critique group at one of our Christmas events. The Beastly Beatitudes of Balthazar B by J.P. Don Levy.
Okay.
So it's kind of a random book. So pick a page between 1 and 400.
Okay, let's do 27.
Okay, and then a sentence between 1 and 3. So one of the first three sentences.
3.
Okay. Ahead, the white cliffs and seagulls soared in the gray sky.
Oh.
We can take as much time as we want.
Read it to me again.
Okay. Ahead, the white cliffs and seagulls soared in the gray sky.
The sounds of the carnival behind me faded as I wandered into the dark.
The dark of the circus tent, which was completely empty. All the revelers had gone for the night, and it was just me standing on the straw floor.
Scattered pieces of popcorn littered the ground, and there was a doorway at the end of the tent where a sliver of light flipped on.
My feet scuffed along the ground as the stench of Elephant feces filled my nostrils. I knew I had to go through this door, but I didn't know what was behind it.
I hesitated before stepping through, knowing that once I entered, there may not be a way out.
I walked through and was immediately met by myself. Not just myself, 1,000 versions of myself. Mirrors, as far as I could see, all at different angles, reflecting me in shapes that seemed almost tormented.
That Mickey Mouse shirt I decided to wear was a mistake.
Mickey's face was distorted in almost what looked like terror. But as I moved, he became more cartoon-like and almost seemed to come to life. I stepped 3 feet forward and wasn't sure what direction was even available to me after that.
And then the lights went out.
I think we call it there.
Okay.
That's wonderful. That was a little bit of the movie. Now I'm going to forget the name of it. Where the kids are in the Hall of Mirrors at the circus, and it was really, really creepy.
I don't know.
But that's fun, right?
Absolutely.
I love seeing it.
What's that book really about?
What's that?
What's that book really about?
I never read it. I don't know.
You recording?
I know. Anyway. I never read it. But yeah, it usually gets, I've had a lot of thriller writers on, so it gets dark really fast. But I'm having some romance writers and some nonfiction writers coming up. So we'll see.
We'll see where
it goes. And the last thing I was going to bring up with you, just because it's very interesting to me is thematically, again, something I think we're similar on. You seem to gravitate towards the idea of, characters disappearing, which I've always been. It's been a big thing for me, and I don't know where that comes from in my life. but I bought this book years ago, How to Disappear, by Frank Ahern. And he's just an expert on, it's probably dated. I don't know if they put out new editions, but it's like, hey, you want to get rid of your, digital footprint. This is how you do it. This is how you actually disappear. Because I love that idea of either starting over or leaving a bad situation. And then how would you, and then I love that idea. And then I love the, okay, how would you actually do it? Cause that's nothing you can take for granted. You have to really know your shit to do this. Mm-hmm. Where do you think that comes from with The Last Flight? That idea, is that something kind of that you just like that almost romantic image of leaving it all behind?
Yes, I think definitely. And I also just think that everybody fantasizes about that, right? And I think the idea really started from when I read an Anne Tyler book not a long time ago, Ladder of Years, which is a story of a mom who and a wife, and she's got, three kind of mostly grown children and a husband who completely takes her for granted, and they're on this beach vacation, and somebody left something back at the house, and they're like, "Mom, will you go back and get it for me?" And she's just like, I'm supposed to be on vacation, right? Like, this is my vacation too. Yeah. And so she's like, fine, I'll go back and get it. And she starts walking back to the rental house and she just keeps walking. Like, she's just done. She's so tired of feeling invisible and taken for granted. So she just keeps walking and she finds the small town and she has, her wallet and her sandals, and she just rents a room. She's just going to stay for the night. But she kind of just wants them to get a feel for like, what would their life be like without her?
Right.
And she kind of plants some seeds in this new town and grows some roots there and starts making friends. She just kind of stays there, for a while. And it's just, I just was so intrigued by that. My mind constantly goes back to that book all the time of just, what does it take for somebody? Like, at what point have you had enough that you're willing to do something like that,
Right. And then also, how do you create that character? What's that balance? Because you could very easily create a character where you start to lose sympathy for them. If they're being kind of leaving your kids behind, that's a big deal, right?
Claire didn't have any kids. Yeah. I mean, and that was one of the reasons why Claire didn't have any kids. And in fact, she didn't have any family at all, because I felt like that would be a complication. It would be an interesting complication.
Sure.
And certainly something that might have been a good thing to have her have. But when I was writing the book, I really wanted her to go in a certain way. And I knew that in order for that to work, I needed her to be with no strings attached, you know?
Right. And there's also something about, like, I think that could be an interesting challenge if they had to leave children. I don't know. I'm good enough to write that.
Sometimes I don't know that I could write it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, I think I could write it, but I think I'd hate myself and I think I'd hate my care. I don't know that I could write it in a way that would keep you sympathetic.
Right. I mean, there are certainly some days I fantasize about it.
Oh, well, yeah. You know,
that's funny. Well, listen, it has been awesome talking to you, and thank you for the blurb, by the way.
Oh, sure. You're very welcome. It was a great book. I'm looking forward to seeing everything happen for it.
Well, I appreciate that. And congrats with all your success. It was fun kind of digging into your past and learning about your little career arc and everything. So I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing your wisdom with me. So
yeah, it was fun. All right.
Enjoy your weekend. Thanks.
I will. You too. Okay. Bye.
So that was my conversation with Julie Clark. I really had a great time talking to her and really appreciated the opportunity to get to know her a little bit better. And if you want to get to know her better, you can go visit her website at julieclarkauthor.com. And if you want to know more about me, my books, my upcoming events, or subscribe to my Pulitzer Prize winning newsletter, it's not really, you can go to carterwilson.com. More episodes of Making It Up out soon. In the meantime, thanks for listening and or watching. Take care.